Shalom. Thank you for joining us on this journey of discovery through the book of Deuteronomy.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome back as we press on through the book of Deuteronomy. And today, we're going to start with a small prayer from Psalms 119, verse 18. It says in Hebrew, beautiful words, Agal aini ve'abita niflaot mitorateka, which really means, open my eyes that I may see the wondrous things from your law. And that is our prayer this morning as we jump into the book of Deuteronomy. Now, before we get right into it, there were a couple of really interesting questions that came up after that last lesson. So I thought maybe I'll take a little bit of time to answer that. The question goes like this. Can we use thou shalt not have other gods as a commandment to explain why one should not have alternative healing methods such as sound waves, acupuncture, you know, traditional Chinese medicine, art therapy, and so on and so forth? First of all, I don't think these things has anything to do with other gods, all right? I mean, that doesn't mean they're credible. It does not mean that these are credible, but it's like nothing. It's like saying that, you know, thou shalt not have other gods does not mean you should not try anything else, right? Because many of these things may remotely have some links. Let's say, for example, Chinese medicine. Some will argue that, you know, it's based on some idea of yin and yang, you know, your ru qi, your leng qi. So all this, not leng qi, liang. So, you know, you have all these sort of ideas which you could trace back to some form of Taoism, but that really isn't about another god. It's a worldview, right? And while we may subscribe to one worldview or another worldview, some people think the earth is flat, but that's not idolatry, right? So I don't think you can use that. Now, that said, there's actually a subsequent question which I think is connected to the same thing, which is it therefore right to use science to reaffirm truths, sound waves and frequencies to explain God? Okay. I think the truth about God is general. You can see God, you know, everywhere. But to use some of these explanations, I think there's some value, maybe some broad value, but specific value I would question. For example, there was a video about how they look into the stars and they saw a cross in the middle of some constellation and say, that's proof of God. It's not proof of God. That's a bit like looking in the clouds and I see a rabbit, right? And maybe God is speaking to you or maybe the rabbit is speaking to you, but that's not necessarily the way we go about discovering God, right? The primary way we discover God is through the Word of God. That's His self-revelation. And yes, He does reveal Himself in a variety of ways, and I think we should be wise in how we do that. Okay, so that question aside, let's jump right into Deuteronomy chapter 24 because it talks about the law of gleaning. You know, that's just verse 19. It says, when you reap your harvest in the field and forget a sheaf, in a few, do not go back and get it. Okay, so you're collecting your. And this really is talking about the story of Ruth, isn't it? You're gleaning from field and you drop something. Okay, if you were Chinese, we will make sure every last thing is. You know, when you leave the field, it's like nothing is left, right? But there's always this kind of room within this culture where you leave a bit of space. You know, don't push everything to the extreme. Don't live. And I think it's a good way to live our lives too. I don't think we should spend your last cent until you have no more space, no more money, no more resources to spend on, you know, other things and other people. And same thing can be said for our time. Most of us, you know, we squeeze our time until there's nothing left of it. Maybe we should have this law of gleaning in our lives, to leave something spare in our life. And that's a beautiful law. Of course, the concern is for the widows, the fathers, so that they can come and there's something left over for them, right? So that's a beautiful I think, law there, and I'm going to jump now to 25. If there is a dispute between men, and they come to court, and the judges may judge them, and they justify the righteous and condemn the wicked, then it shall be that if the wicked man deserves to be beaten, that the judge will cause him to lie down and be beaten in his presence according to his guilt with a certain number of blows. 40 blows he may give and no more, lest he should exceed this and beat him with many blows above these, and your brother be humiliated in your sight. Now, very interesting, a little bit curious law. Here's a law where, you know, you have two brothers, and brothers, I guess it would mean here, both people of the covenant, all right? So, sons of Israel. And you have a dispute. The first thing we know that, you know, even among Christians, we have dispute. That's a reality. I think sometimes we come to church and think that in church, there'll never be dispute. So, the moment there's any dispute, we're like, oh my goodness, right? You know what? The world is such that there will always be disputes. Well, what do you do when you have dispute? You bring them before this judge, and the judge will preside over this case, right? Now, in some cases, the man may be beaten as a punishment. I'm not quite sure exactly what sort of punishment will warrant that. But the punishment is correspondent to the severity of the transgression, right? So I think that's a good way. Many of us think, you know, how should you punish someone? Well, the punishment must commensurate with the transgression, right? So if it's a very serious crime, of course, there'll be a bigger punishment. But then it says, 40 blows he may give and no more. Okay, so even though the punishment corresponds and commensurates with the transgression, there is a limit that you cannot go above. You know, once I was in Japan, and I had been using my roaming on my phone, right? I shan't mention the provider. But, you know, I was using data for my Google getting around, and I was so happy with it, right? And, of course, what I did not know was that the data price would keep going up without a ceiling. So when I came back, I had a $2,000 bill, you know, so it was scary, right? But now, they have a limit. They say if you go above, you know, something like $90 or something like that, I don't know what's the new one, but, you know, it will not go above that anymore. This is a little bit like that. This is a little bit like that. And that is really an expression of grace, isn't it? Because we do not get all that we deserve. You get some punishment, of course. You do not. If you don't get any punishment, that will be unjust, right? So you do get some punishment, but there's grace in the punishment of God. Now, it says 40 blows is the maximum, right? Now, if you look in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 24, this is Paul, right?
From the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus 1.
Okay, so Paul says 5 times he's been punished with a maximum allowed punishment, right? But minus 1, why do you think they did that? Why do you suppose they punish him? Like, you know, you're allowed to go to 40, but why did they say minus 1? Yes, exactly. So this is, you know, in case they lost count, you see. If you lost count, maybe, you know, you got so excited about whipping the guy and it's like, you know, 39, and it's just like, you know, or 38, you count twice. Just in case you lose count, they just reduce it by 1 in order to stay just inside of the limit of the law. Because the law says that you cannot do more than this. So in order to keep the law, they created one more law that says that you cannot go up to 40, right? Now, this is basically what the fence law is. It's not in the law, but it's what we do. We add an additional law to prevent yourself from getting there. And this, you see this happening quite a bit in Jewish culture, right? In a rabbinic tradition and so on and so forth. Okay, so that's 1 to 3. You go on to, then out in the middle, verse 4.
Verse 4, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain.
Okay, so first of all, it's a little bit odd. First, you're talking about brother in court, right? And then suddenly you have this thing. Now, what exactly is the meaning of this verse? You shall not muzzle an ox. By the way, Paul likes this. He uses this several times in writing Timothy and others. And now, an ox will work, right? It's a beast of burden. But a donkey is also a beast of burden. Both of them are pulling, but the ox is far stronger than the mule, right? So if you put them together in the same yoke, what happens? The ox will do all the work. The ox will do all the work, right? And because, you know, sometimes when I'm asking my daughter to help me with things, instead of pushing, she hang on to the thing, I'm dragging her along, right? So, I mean, when she was little, I hope she doesn't watch this. But I think sometimes this whole idea is that if you have unequal persons involved, one person will do all the work and it will be unfair for the ox because the mule is not going to do, it's just going to tag along, right? It cannot keep up with the strength of the ox. And that is what it means to be unequally yoked. That's the original context, you know. And of course, Paul didn't just make this up in Corinthians. He actually was quoting an idea. But this idea here originally has to do with unfairness. It has to do with fairness and parity and, you know, being well matched. But as this, I guess you can say, proverb over time grew, you know, it started to be used for all kinds of unfairness, right? So by the time you get to, Corinthians, it has become a general saying for anything unfair, including being in relationships, right? So that law about being unequally yoked was not originally about marriage. It was not originally. It's a general rule. It could apply to anything. It could apply to two persons working on the same project together, right? And some of us just finished your PSLE, but you know, in school, sometimes you're assigned a project, right? You have project group, and one person does all the work, right? And then two of them slacking away, but they all get the same marks. That is unfairness, okay? So I thought maybe I throw that out there because, you know, I think it's interesting for us to think about how we can apply this law more broadly in our lives. In project teams, you know, there are some people who don't do work that it's not fair to, you know, assign them that way. Okay, so muzzling an ox. Okay, so I think I actually did this in a sermon recently where I said that, you know, when the ox is treading the floor, sometimes it's tempted to eat the grain, right? It's eat the, and you would think in order to maximize your gains, you will not let the ox eat anything. And this is where you say, no, look, the poor ox is working. Let it eat as it works, right? Let it eat as it works. And of course, this can be broadly applied to, applied to any kind of situation where you have people working for you. And it is right and it is acceptable for these people. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, because I know we have all these governance laws today, so they're very strict about how things are. But in general, where it doesn't contravene whatever civil laws there might be, it is right for the person who's working to enjoy the benefits. Of course, that's where I think 1 Corinthians 9:9 and Timothy comes in, where it says, you know, the hardworking farmer should be allowed to be the first one to enjoy it, right? He's the first one because he's right there on the field. He enjoys the fruit of his labor, right? So let's be reasonable. Let's not be overly stingy. Okay, 25, verse 5. And this, by the way, this whole section is what is sometimes known as the law of levirate marriage, right? So it's so-called levir. Levir is, I think it's Latin. It's not, it's nothing to do with Levites, okay? It's so-called, because I think it's a Latin word that means brother or something like this. So if brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside of the family. Okay, so let's think about this for a second, right? This is a cultural context. Okay, this doesn't apply to us in general. Okay, just to be very clear about that. So, a woman is widowed. The husband dies. She is not allowed to marry outside of the family. She must marry one of the brothers, assuming there is a brother, right? So, the brother now has a duty, it says in verse 5, to perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. What is that duty? What is that duty? To give her a child, all right? Because without children, you know, the whole line is gone. So the husband's duty, right, is to give her a child, right? And we know how that comes about. So it shall be that the firstborn, which the firstborn son that she bears, will succeed in the name of the dead brother, right? So this first son now would inherit everything that the dead brother left, right? It will not be the son of this brother that she remarried. So this whole thing is known as the law of the levirate marriage. And the reason they wanted to do this is given there is so that his name will not be blotted out. You see that in verse 6, right? So we mentioned in the past that to blot out the remembrance of a person is a kind of curse. It's seen as a kind of punishment. And for many of them, the whole idea is to keep your line going. You know, I have to think about that because I only have a daughter, right? And my daughter asked me, do you want me to get married? I say, you're an adult, you think about it. But I guess for them, it was a big deal to have sons and to have the son bear the family name and carry on in that way. My brother, United States, has no children. He has many cats, right? So, but my sister is married out of the family. We have a problem, right? If we were Jews, this would be a kind of problem. Now, it says that if a man does not want to do this, okay? So let's say now you have a situation, the brother dies, and this other brother, for whatever reason, he does not want to perform this duty. Okay, verse 7, it says, if he does not want to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go to the gate of the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel. He will not perform the duty of, I mean, look, this is a bit of a scandal, isn't it, right? He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. And that is really just a euphemism, you know. That's a nice way of saying something that I wouldn't just outright mention. Here we'll keep this PG-18, right? PG-12 or something like that, right? So, and he says, then the elders of the city, verse 8, shall call him, okay, this guy is going to be called up, right, to the gates of the city where all the elders are sitting, there'll be a council there, and speak to him. But if he stands firm and says, I do not want to take her, okay, I can't stand her for whatever reason, or you know, my wife won't allow me to do that, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of all the presence of the elders, remove his sandal from his foot, okay, and spit in his face, oh my goodness, and say, so shall it be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house, and his name shall be called in Israel the house of him who had his sandal removed. Wow, okay, that is so cool and so weird, all right? It's actually, we have a story just like this in the Bible. Anyone want to know? Guess where? Where? No, Ruth's case, he was more than happy to do it. He wanted it so much, he was make sure that no one else gets it, right? Just make sure, right? Okay, let's look at Genesis chapter 38, verse 6 to 10. This is about Judah, right?
Genesis 38, verse 6 to 10. Then Judah took a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. And Judah said to Onan, go in to your brother's wife and marry her, and raise up an heir to your brother. But Onan knew that the heir would not be his, and it came to pass, when he went in to his brother's wife, that he emitted on the ground, lest he should give an heir to his brother. And the thing which he did displeased the Lord. Therefore, he killed him also.
Okay. So that's a lot in that story, okay? I mean, obviously, you know why nobody preaches about this, right? Because there's just too much going on here. So, Judah has two sons, okay? One of them is what do you all call your son's name, you know? Okay, we'll call him right? And then he has another son, Onan. Now, is killed because he was a wicked person. So, he leaves behind a widow. So, according to this law of levirate marriage, right, the son that's alive, Onan, has a husband's duty, has to perform a husband's duty for this wife of right? But Onan did not want to do it. Why? Because he felt that, look, what's the point of me raising this child? All the effort and resources going to this child when he will not bear my name. He's going to bear my brother's name, right? So he doesn't want to do this. Now, here, what did he do? He went into this widow's, widow, right? Which means to say that they had marital relationships. But he did not, complete it, all right? Let's just put it that way, okay? Now, this whole thing here has often been used as a kind of argument against, let's say, masturbation, right? As it's nothing to do, onanism, sometimes as it's called, has nothing to do with that. It has to do with this law. That's the first thing. The second thing that's so interesting is that here, you don't just get, I would think getting slapped in the face with a sandal and being spit on is better than getting killed by the Lord. So this is a pretty serious matter, very serious matter, right? This is such a serious, transgression that it warranted the death penalty. I don't know what you think about that, but that seems to be pretty serious, right? Now, the other thing that maybe is worth noting is that Genesis 38 came before the law. So here was a pre-existing cultural law that was important enough that, well, it says God killed him, okay? Whether it was actually God killed him or not, I think we can debate about it, but certainly the whole community saw it as God's punishment on this person. And that also helps you to understand where are these laws coming from. Remember we said that Moses was doing the job of a bit of a cultural adapter for these laws, right? He wasn't just like God told him to make this law. He was taking a principle, I think, okay? This is my opinion. God gave him some principles and he had to take these principles, look at what is evident in the culture and say, okay, this law works, and he has that job of applying that into the various cases, the reality of life. And when you see this law in Deuteronomy chapter 25, you can almost see that this is a direct reflection of what is already a culturally existing law. It wasn't a law that came into existence on Mount Sinai. It was a law that's already existent. And Moses was simply incorporating some of this law. Now, if this were true, then it would also be true for some of these other laws. Some of these laws could be a bit puzzling to us. Now, honestly, if we are not told a lot about this law, it would sound very strange, puzzling. Why would God do? Why would you do such a humiliating thing to a person? Well, that's actually something quite important. And the thing that ties up, I think, maybe the first three bits of law in Deuteronomy 25, is that it has something to do with honor. Right? First of all, you don't want to humiliate this person by whipping him too often, right? It says so that he will not be humiliated. You don't want to yoke two person, you know, I mean, one, making one person work more than and have another, maybe something to do with honor because he can't do well. And here again is this whole idea of honor. So honor is a very important in Middle Eastern, ancient Near East culture, something to, for us to keep in mind. But the culture is not the same as our culture today. I don't think any pastor would say that, you know, the widow must marry the, you know, the husband's brother if he's a Christian or something. No one would say this because we recognize that these were culturally framed laws. Okay, so when you look at the law of the Old Testament, many times you have to look beyond the letter of the law to understand the principles and the concerns behind the law rather than just taking it at the face value, all right?
Pastor Dan,
yep.
What maybe you could explain a bit of how the Jews, in this sense, in this case, how this fledgling nation saw families and maybe even how they, why it was so, I mean, David raised a good point that it's quite burdensome, to and quite a tax on somebody's personal freedom to make them marry and support a wife and kids, yeah. Right? But why is it so important to, as it were, to build your brother's house?
I think it sounds strange to many of us when you see some of these laws because we are very different. We are a highly individualized society, right? We think about personal rights. As you know, I am an individual. I'm independent of all these other people, even sometimes independent of my family. I will do whatever I want to do. But if you roll the clock back that far, and maybe not even that far, at an earlier time in our human civilization, things were not always like this. People were viewed collectively, right? So when a punishment is meted out upon one person's sin, the Achan guy, right? Achan, everybody suffers. So that's this whole idea. And so when Adam sins, it's like, what did we do? We were not even born back then. Adam's, you know, he makes that mistake and all of us are dragged into this. So I think maybe it is good for us to maybe step down a little bit from our very self-centric view of history and time. We are only existing in this very last part of history, right? The kind of culture that we are seeing today, probably not more than a few hundred years out of a span of thousands upon years of human history. Yet, you know, sometimes we tend to think our way is the way it should be, right? But for the longest time, that was not the case. People were viewed, their rights were viewed collectively, right? And what one person did, you would punish, and nobody would think that as particularly strange, although I would say they did, right? They did. It wasn't an easy thing. But families were seen as, and remember the laws about honoring your parents, right? Laws, and that law really sees the father in particular as the head of a whole tribe. So you could say it was very tribal, right? The view of family, the view of society as a whole, they were all very tribal. And of course, you have the chief of all these tribes, right? In the form of your king. So, yeah, I think they would see things, and things that may be important to them won't be so important to us. For example, even in the New Testament, there's a law that says you cannot care for your own family members. You're worse than, you know, one of these other sinners, right? And for us today, we might find that a little bit strange. You know, everyone takes care of themselves. Government has the duty of taking care of individuals. In our day, we may not think of that as something very important, partly because we have shifted socially to a very highly... Now, is this a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Well, I think there's some good. There's probably some bad to it, as always, right? So we just have to work out our own faith in our own context. You know, I hope that answers the question a little bit. Verse 11, okay, so there's some strange stuff here, okay? Verse 11 and 12. No, I'm not even going to read this, right? Go home if you want something interesting to read. Read Deuteronomy chapter verse 11 and 12 and you figure out yourself what this law is all about. As far as I can understand it, it's something to do with honor, okay? And it's, you know, it may not make sense to us as modern 21st century Christians, but trust me, a lot of it has to do with honor, okay? I'm just not going to touch that, okay? I mean, that, like, okay. So verse 13 to 16, maybe that's a lot easier for us to swallow. It says, you shall not have in your bag differing weights, okay? So basically, this whole bit of text is about cheating. Right. So what are differing weights? It's like you have 1 kg, right? 1 kg, but it's actually 0.9 kg. And then you have another one that's the actual 1 kg, right? So when you're trading, you say, I'll buy, you know, of course they didn't have kgs, you know, they have other measures, right? And you use these different weights in order to basically cheat, right? So, okay, this is not new. It happens, you know, it has always happened. People have always been cheating one way or another. And it says in verse 15, you shall have a perfect and just weight, a perfect and just measure. Now, of course, the whole principle is that you shall be honest in your dealings with people, right? And that your days may be lengthened. Okay, does it mean that if your weights are accurate, right, that your days will be lengthened? I mean, that's the literal meaning. The literal meaning is that if your weights are accurate, of course, these days we have digital weights and all that, right? Or maybe, okay, here's a situation that, you know, I was just coming to. You go buy a car, right? You look at the car, at the mileage. Now, you know, some people temper the mileage, right? To make it look like the car is new. Now, that would be something like this, right? But suppose you did not do it. So you are an honest person, right? According to this verse, the literal reward is you will live a long life, basically, right? Now, I think when we read this as Christians, you know, we have this tendency to say, yeah, I've been honest. God owes me a long life. Okay, first, it doesn't really work that. I hate to disappoint you. I think you have to understand that, you know, this is a way of saying that, okay, God will bless you generally. It doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, if everyone lives up to 75, you're going to make it to 95. It does not literally carry in that way. But it certainly does mean that, yeah, God will be happy. He will be pleased. And if God is pleased, then His favor will be upon you in whichever ways that come upon you, all right? But I don't think we should take it literally that this is what it means, right? So I think maybe something for us to think about, very useful in terms of how we read many of the promises of the Bible, which we tend to take quite literally, right? But often these are being presented as a kind of figure of speech, maybe, right? Okay, so continuing to that, more importantly, verse 16, right? So what happens if you cheat? What happens if you have different ways? Let's say you're someone who not an honest businessman. Okay, look at this. For all who do such things, we are on verse 16 now, all who behave unrighteously, and here, to be unrighteous will be exactly what we just described, right? Dishonest. They are a to'eva to the Lord your God. There are not a whole lot of things that are an abomination to the Lord. This is one of them. So, let's think about this, right? Remember, recently we talked about the number of things. There were a whole bunch of offering a blemished sacrifice to God is an abomination, right? We talk about homosexual acts, that was an abomination to God. We talk about idolatry, that was an abomination to God. Cross-dressing, that's an abomination to God. But look, cheating is also an abomination to God. As bad as any of those other things, as bad as, say, idolatry would be pretty bad, right? So for all you guys who are on your way to work this morning, maybe you're a businessman, think about this, right? God loves integrity in our business. And if we cheat in our business, or you cheat in anything, in God's eyes, you see, not necessarily in our, you know, eyes, because maybe we accept some of these things, but in God's eyes, this is an abomination. What do you think about that? Now, this whole section here now has to do with Amalek, okay? And Amalek is one of these tribes that attacked Israel. And then it says here in verse 17, remember what Amalek did to you as you were coming out of Egypt, how they met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks. Now, what are rear ranks? You have this 600,000 men, and maybe you count women, probably around 2 million people with women, children, animals, right? So it's a very long procession as they're coming out from Egypt, and all the strong men will be up in front, right? So those guys who cannot move, like myself, you know, we'll find ourselves trailing at the back, right? So the stragglers, the sick, the poor, the, you know, akong ama, right? Your grandparents, the children, and the weak, they will all be at the back. So what did Amalek do? Amalek did not attack the front. You see, that would be the honorable thing to do, right? The honorable thing to do is, you know, in the past, honorable gentlemen settle things with a fight, right? And I will fight you, and I'll fight you honestly, right? There's a certain honor even in fighting. These Amalek, they were not honorable. They did not come after the soldiers. They went after the weakest of the weak. Now you might say, that's war. But you know what? Even among warring factions, there is a certain code of honor, strangely, right? If you think about gangsters, you know, when they fight, sometimes there's even a, not always, but sometimes there's even a code of honor. There are certain things you're not allowed to do, right? Like maybe what we just skipped over reading in verse level, right? There's some things you're not allowed to do. And that was considered dishonorable. So Amalek, they were dishonorable. I mean, the fact that they attacked them, many people attacked the Egyptians attacked, for example, Israel, right? Lots of people fought with Israel. How is it that only Amalek was singled out for this, right? Such a special remembrance. Moses remembered after 40 years and now he's dying, right? And he still remembers all those guys. Why did he remember those guys? Well, because they didn't fight fairly. So I think if you look at this whole chapter 25, it's something to do with fairness, honor, integrity. This that kind of chapter, that, you know, the, those laws. So Amalek, because they were dishonorable, they are to be utterly destroyed. Okay? So that verse, the last verse says, they will be, you blot out the remembrance of Amalek under heaven. You will not forget. Wow. That's pretty serious, right? Now, how extensively do you think they prosecuted this particular? What do you think? Did they fully obey this? 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 2.
2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 2. On the third day, behold, it happened that a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dust on his head. So it was when he came to David that he fell to the ground and prostrated himself.
Okay, so David, you know, David was at war, okay? So there was this guy from Saul's camp who ran out from Saul's camp, maybe part of Saul's army, right? He came up to David and fell in front of David and said, I've escaped from the camp of Israel. Okay, so this is the thing that happened. But who was this person who escaped? Let's kind of read, maybe continue looking at verse 13.
Then David said to the young man who told him, where are you from? And he said, I am the son of an alien, an Amalekite.
Okay, so, you know, the Amalekites have been there. Saul was fighting with Amalekites. He was a man who escaped. And so they were not utterly destroyed. They were clearly around for a long time. Keep in mind, by the time you get to Saul and David, hundreds of years have passed since the time. So they were not actually fully destroyed. If you were to read, for example, Deuteronomy chapter 25, you would think that there would be no more Amalekites left. You know, at least not wherever they could help it, right? So I think sometimes when we read some of these laws, we have to kind of like pull back maybe 20% discount in that how they prosecuted these laws, they did not always carry it to its utter extreme, so to speak. Okay, let's quickly look at chapter 26. Not a whole lot here. We're going to finish up chapter 26 and then we're into our final stretch. Verse 1 to 11 really has to do with this first fruit thanksgiving, right? And verse 3 tells us the reason why you want to have this first fruit, this thanksgiving. Okay, maybe you can read for us chapter 26, verse 3.
And you shall go to the one who is priest in those days and say to him, I declare today the Lord your God that I have come to the country which the Lord swore to our fathers to give us.
Okay, so basically here you have a whole series of instructions of how you should celebrate. And what is it that you're celebrating? Not so much that you have defeated your enemies. You celebrated the fact that God kept his covenant. Okay, that is what you're celebrating. That God kept his promises. So that was actually a very explicit, and this is how we should give thanks. You know, whenever God has done something in our lives, we are supposed to give thanks that God has done it. Not necessarily that you did it or you got something, but the fact that God has been faithful. They were actually rejoicing over God's faithfulness. All right. So in verse 11, let's have a look at verse 11. It says, so you shall rejoice in every good thing which the Lord your God has given you and your house and the Levite and the stranger who is among you. Okay, so, you know, the question just now was, how did they view society? We tend to think, God bless me, right? But here, you're supposed to say, God bless me and the strangers and the pastors who are living in my house or something like that, right? The full-time people, God bless my community. It's not just me. And of course, you think about the New Testament where it says, you know, when one part of the body suffers, all suffer with it, right? One part rejoices, all rejoice with it. I mean, that whole kind of mindset really comes from this whole ancient Near East culture where, you know, people see themselves collectively, right? So we are supposed to rejoice in every good thing that God does. You know, I don't know if we do that a lot, but if you think about it, this is actually a law. It is a law to rejoice and to be happy, to be thankful when God has done good things in our life, right? Sometimes, you know, we're so pessimistic, right? So maybe we should think about that. So be rejoicing today, you know, as you go about your day. And verse 24, 12 to 15, these are tithing laws, right? And let me see. Verse 14, it says, I've not eaten of any. Okay, so what happens is that you're supposed to put aside a tithe. Now, in addition to your regular tithe, there's, now some people say 10%. Actually, you really read that. There are many 10% here, 10% there. By the time you add it all up, it's actually a lot more than 10%. But this one is every 3 years. You are supposed to put aside something for 3 years. And after 3 years, you bring the whole 10% to the house of the Lord, which is a bit complicated because a lot of the products were actually perishables. You can't necessarily keep them for 3 years, right? I mean, you know, if the vegetable, how are you going to do it, right? Unless it becomes kiam chai la, you have to do something to it, to keep it. But in any case, this man proclaims, right, in verse 14, that I did not touch it, right? You know how sometimes we put aside something for God, right? But then you don't give it straight away. So you're tempted to, I think I would. Okay, this guy says in verse 14, he says, I have removed the holy tithe from my house and I've given them, okay, blah, blah, blah. I have not transgressed your commandment, nor have I forgotten. I've not eaten any of it in the morning, nor have removed any of it. So this is being honest, right? Since you have put this aside for God, of course, we know this whole story of Ananias and Sapphira, right? They did not, they touched it. They shouldn't have touched it. Because once you have put it aside, it's no longer yours, right? So that's that. And let's wrap this all up with verse 16 to 19. Let's have a look at that. Verse 16 to 19. This is the day, this day, the Lord your God commands you to observe all this. And this is really the end. Okay, we are coming to the end of this entire section. So up to chapter 27, I think. End of chapter 26. That's the whole of the section that we began from, I guess, chapter 12 or 13 onwards up to now. Okay, so now it says, this is it. Listen to all these things. You shall be careful to observe them with all your heart and with all your soul. Remember to love your God with all your heart and to all your soul. And here it says to keep them. So to love God is to keep His commandments, really. And that's what Jesus says, right? If you love me, you will keep my commandments. So in the Hebrew mind, loving God is not some abstract romantic feeling or sentimental feeling. Oh, you know, I sing a few songs, you know, that sort of thing, right? It's nothing whatsoever to do with that. It's very clear cut, cut and dry. You love God, it simply means you keep His commandments, right? You do what He wants you. And everything else is extra and maybe even optional, right? So singing a song, writing a song, dancing, these things are all secondary to keeping His commandments. You don't keep the commandments, all of the rest mean almost nothing, right? So you go all the way, and if you do this, and today the Lord has proclaimed you to be His special people, just as His promised. Now, of course, this is a reference to Exodus chapter 18, right? 18, where it says, you will be my special people if you keep my commandments. That is the whole covenant promise. I will be your God, you will be my people. So if you do all these commandments, right, you do all these things, this is what keeping the covenant, keeping the covenant means. And you do this, you will become His special people, His, you know, His royal priesthood, His holy nation, and all that stuff. You keep all His commandments, and the result, okay, the bonus of this, He will set you high above all nations which He has made, in praise, in name, in honor, right? He set you high in praise, in name, and in honor. Not necessarily in wealth, in power, in strength, right? Not necessarily in those things, but in, at least in these things. And that you may be a holy people to the Lord your God, just as He's spoken. So that really, I mean, we wrap this this episode up with this. Very good place to end. That God's idea is not simply to bless you or to punish you. He has a purpose to make the covenant people so that He can tell the world, look, guys, this is my showcase. This is how I want you all to be. To be honest, to be honorable. This is how I want you to flee from idolatry. And God wanted someone to be His, I guess, representative, right? His sort of like showcase to people. His showroom house, if you like. But of course, they didn't do really well. But in any case, that whole section ends. We're going to continue from chapter 27 onwards as we come back with our next episode. And we are in the final stretch. Okay, so let's just kind of hang in there. God bless all of you. I'll see you all back in the next episode.
We hope you enjoyed studying the Word of God. Join us again as we continue through the book of Devarim.